Hi, I'm Chris Cotnor, executive producer of the DSR Network. We've been incredibly busy here over the past month. With the launch of TNR's Daily Blast, we now produce 10 shows covering foreign policy, national security, domestic politics, cyber and tech, legal, and much more. We've also just launched our redesigned website at thedsrnetwork.com. With all this content, there has never been a better time to become a member. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack community. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. Hell hath no fury like Marjorie Taylor Greene scorned. Scorned by House Speaker Mike Johnson, that is. At this point, Representative Greene seems to be attacking Johnson almost every day over aid to Ukraine, over funding for the Justice Department, and over illegals that Johnson is supposedly helping release into the country. Greene's crusade against Johnson, while amusing in a deeply twisted way, raises some very consequential questions. What's really going on with the MAGA right in the House right now? How much leeway will they give to Johnson to deliver some sort of aid package on Ukraine, as he's pledged to do? How much leverage is Donald Trump really wielding over the House GOP? The stakes here are really high. Here to demystify all of this for us is Liam Donovan, a GOP lobbyist and Twitter virtuoso, who is a very shrewd observer of the House GOP conference. Really glad to have you here, Liam.
Thanks, Greg. It's great to be here.
Liam, so the latest from MTG is that she introduced a motion to vacate the speaker, but is kind of holding it in reserve. She's angry because the House passed a $1.2 trillion bill funding the government and averting a shutdown, among many other things she's angry about. Here's what she said.
I filed the motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning and a pink slip. I respect our conference. I paid all my dues to my conference. I'm a member in good standing, and I do not wish to inflict pain on our conference and to throw the house in chaos. But this is basically a warning, and it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority.
Can you explain how the motion to vacate works, why Greene is doing this now, and what she thinks she's accomplishing with this?
Sure. So first and foremost, Greg, if we think about the motion to vacate, what it is a tool that's existed for more than a century. It really dates back to 1910. The first time this was used, the last time until this past September, but it allows one single member of the body to go to the floor, offer this motion, and there is a prescribed amount of time that the speaker has to schedule that vote. And what happens is it is a resolution declaring that the office of X, in this case the speaker, is vacant. It is essentially a vote of no confidence. If she decided tomorrow to offer it, then that would trigger the process by which Johnson would have to essentially allow this vote to take place. How it would play out, we don't really know. I think there's a lot of things we can get into here. But in terms of the procedure, he would have a finite amount of time to schedule that vote. We played games with this back in September of what they could do to sort of what McCarthy might have done to prevent this from happening. But of course, once you call the question in a majority such as this, the paper thin one that they have, really the power goes over to Democrats, as long as there are one, two, three, whatever the margin is at any given point, Republicans that are interested in seeing what happens in the chaos.
Yeah, I want to get to that. Right now, though, one of the biggest sticking points for Green seems to be that Speaker Johnson does want to hold some kind of vote on aid to Ukraine. Now, in my world, people hear Johnson saying he wants to do this, and they just dismiss it. Oh, it's just a stalling tactic. Johnson will never actually do it. But now it's being reported pretty widely that he really appears to want to do it. A few ideas seem to be in circulation. Maybe it would be linked to a demand to lift President Biden's moratorium on liquid natural gas imports, or to some new border security measures, or perhaps it would be partly a loan to Ukraine. What's your sense of where the thinking really is on this among top Republicans?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, this has been bearing down on him for some time. Obviously, we've been wrestling with this question of what to do about Ukraine aid since before he was speaker, since it was McCarthy as the speaker. It was always going to be something that he had to grapple with. To your point, and to your previous question's implication, I do think the warning and the reason she's offering this now is a shot across the bow, in essence. Don't put Ukraine on the floor, or else I will, you know, sort of pull the pin on this weapon. Now, I do think things fundamentally changed in terms of Johnson's calculus, in terms of the pressures within the Republican conference in the House when the Senate sent over the bill that they did when they did with the votes they did. You know, 70 senators, including a good chunk of the Republican conference, sent over a whatever it was, $100 billion or so bill. Of course, not just Ukraine. It had other items in there. It had Israel. It had Taiwan. That sending that over put Johnson on the clock. They're trying to finesse this and take the question of Ukraine, should we do it or not, and try to massage it in a way that could be sold to, maybe not to Marjorie Taylor Greene, but to the meaty middle of the conference, to voters who are at the end of the day, you know, what this is supposed to be about. And quite frankly, you know, the elephant in the room we haven't mentioned here, but to former President Trump, who for a variety of reasons has strong feelings about this conflict, about the folks involved in it. But one thing he's indicated at some level is, well, perhaps you could structure this in a way that would be less bad. Perhaps you could make this a loan or a, you know, sort of lend-lease type arrangement. And so I do think there are ways to soften the political blow of this. And remember, you know, this is not, there is a vocal minority for whom this is an existential political matter. You know, for maybe half, you know, it's a diminishing number of supporters, but for certainly half the conference or so, they would prefer to do this. The Speaker of the House, as distinct from, you know, Congressman Johnson that was just a rank and file member some short months ago, is privy to all of the intelligence and all of the, you know, the confidential details of what is going on the ground. And I think that fundamentally changes your perspective from something that's about what your next tweet is, what your fundraising is, or what your, you know, what your performative political theatrics are, versus at the end of the day, what this means to the United States, what it means for our national security, and what the right thing to do is. And so I think all that is what Johnson's grappling with. Where does he go with it? You know, I think once the Senate passed what they did, it became pretty clear ultimately he was going to have to be willing to put something on the floor. You mentioned one version of this that I think maybe it's clever, maybe it's a little bit too clever, but I do think the idea of pairing something that is politically tricky for Republicans with something that's politically tricky for Democrats in the LNG pause could be a brilliant way to do this. Maybe it falls apart, but I think doing things like that helps to soften the blow, helps to deflect the complaints. If you can own Biden at some level while doing the right thing, I think that becomes easier for the meaty middle of the conference to do what it probably wants to do and vote for this and just kind of get it over with and go out and campaign. I think he'll have to put it on the floor. And you know, this goes back to what it's wrapped in, right? Is it wrapped with something that's seen as a poison pill that, you know, that is going to need more iterations? Maybe that will happen. But I think he's not gonna have a whole lot of choice. I don't think bottling this up is a tenable proposition.
You alluded to an irony here. By making the threat of a motion to vacate, Green has set up a possible scenario in which House Democrats bail out Johnson in exchange for a vote on Ukraine aid. Interestingly, the big players on both sides are being kind of quiet and evasive about this scenario. How real is it in your mind, and what does it look like if it happens?
See, that's the problem is I think when framed in those terms, it's a mess. That's a bad setup for Johnson. And quite frankly, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is a different political player, different brain than Matt Gaetz. If you look back to September, this was not under these circumstances, not about Ukraine, but this is precisely what Matt Gaetz was trying to set up for himself, which was either he gets rid of McCarthy and mission accomplished, or Democrats save McCarthy and McCarthy is doomed by virtue of his rescue, right, at the hands of Democrats. And so obviously I think if you've listened to Jeffries, if you listen to Congressman Boyle on your show, there are a variety of reasons to think that Johnson has not gone to the same lengths to alienate Democrats. The mood is different. The circumstances are different if he's being, in this case, punished by his conference for, let's say, doing the right thing. I simply don't think it's tenable for a Republican speaker to serve at some level at the pleasure of a coalition that is not his own. And this is the fundamental disparity that's been on display all Congress between the coalition of the right that gave McCarthy the gavel and now for now gives Johnson the gavel versus the coalition that actually does the governing, that actually keeps the lights on, that actually passes anything to law.
The competition to be a kind of big MAGA player is really intense, right? You had Green and Lauren Boebert having a falling out as well. I mean, how do the incentives work for these ambitious MAGA members, really?
It's an interesting question. I mean, the incentive structures are the most confounding part of this Congress. It is the complicating factor in the broader, I think, identity crisis that the party's in. It's still genuinely feeling out who it is, what it means, what its worldview is. And, whereas you used to show up in Congress and you kind of had two paths, maybe you're just happy to be here and you're part of that backbench conference. But for the most part, people would come and either, accrue institutional power by getting on committees and working their way up and, sort of being somebody in that way, maybe, bringing home the bacon or otherwise, being a player on issues that matter to your district back home, or you want to be a player in the national party. You work your way up the leadership ladder. You do what Kevin McCarthy did and start as the chief deputy whip and climb every rung of the ladder. I think increasingly, and this was something that certainly existed before as being kind of a gadfly and building up credibility with the base. But I think there's been people have noticed that the Republican base reviles its leadership. It reviles its establishment. You need to look no further than President Trump's rise, which used the party establishment as a foil and was able to reach the highest peaks of governance. And so, I think a recognition of that comes with what Taylor Greene does, with what everybody does, is using social media, using all the channels available to them. When you kick Marjorie Taylor Greene off committees, that doesn't harm her in the way that it might have previously. I mean, that used to be the best tool that the speaker had, was taking Tim Huell's camp off the ag committee in the biggest ag district in the country cost him his seat at the end of the day, because that's what matters to him and that's what matters to his constituents. I'm not sure that's true of Marjorie Taylor Greene's constituents. They like what she's doing. They like what she's saying. And we get the representatives that we ask for and that we continue to elect. So that incentive structure that you mentioned really is the key to understanding the dysfunction that we have today. It's the key to understanding, the state of the Republican Party in a lot of ways. And it's the key to understanding watching the institution. I mean, the other news on Friday, leaving aside the Marjorie Taylor Greene motion to vacate, think about this. You had the sitting chair of the Appropriations Committee, who just capped her career by passing, this big trillion-dollar bill. She'd already announced her retirement, which was notable and something of a surprise. But she said, I don't want to be chair anymore. She stepped down as chair. She said, I'm not going to do this anymore. At the same time, you had a congressman in Mike Gallagher who was thought to be either a future speaker or a future president or a future, you fill in the blank. He's a chairman of another committee, the Select Committee on China Competition. He said he's resigning. Not only is he resigning, but he's resigning at a future date that actually prevents there from being a special election to fill his seat, so leaving the speaker another seat down. So it gives you an idea of why the people who are coming to Congress are doing what they're doing, and the people who are leaving Congress, exactly why they're leaving. Because if you came here to get anything done, if you came here to govern, you're probably in the wrong building. And especially if you're a 40-year-old with the world at his fingertips, you can kind of go do whatever you want, and wasting your time in Washington right now probably isn't the place for you.
Right. You're certainly in the wrong conference, that's for sure, if you want to get stuff done. Let me sort of suggest something here. I think you're getting at a broad thematic, right, which is that a lot of Republican politics kind of exists in this kind of fantasy place that I think we should probably call MAGA, right? I mean, think of the contrast between the Democratic and Republican conferences on this. Sure, you've got your online superstars like AOC on the Democratic side, but a lot of what happens in Democratic politics is still pretty conventional. It's the stuff you're talking about. It's the speaker exercising influence through typical channels. On the Republican side, there's just this kind of celebrity that you can attain in this fantasy universe that just kind of blows through all that stuff and renders it kind of meaningless. And that brings me to my final question for you, Liam. Is Marjorie Taylor Greene's rage at Mike Johnson based in anything? Is there a real constituency for it? Or is it all just smoke and mirrors, an illusion created by Bannon's podcast and X and far-right media and so forth? If Johnson does go through with Ukraine aid, will she pull the trigger and will he go down?
Well, I think the first question is an interesting one, because you say, is there a market for it? I think whether or not there's a genuine level of disgust with Johnson or what he's done, I think there absolutely, we've seen there is a market. And so reflecting the rage that exists within a certain element of the base is a powerful political proposition. It might not get you, you know, a statewide victory in a state like Georgia. It might not take you to, you know, the presidency. Maybe it will. We'll see this fall. But I think there's certainly a market, and that gets back to the incentive structure that you mentioned. Now, will it take down a speaker? You know, unfortunately, I think this is one of those things where, as we mentioned for a variety of reasons, and I'm like reluctant to even talk about it, but like, if Johnson does what he thinks is right, and that is a sentiment shared by, you know, the majority of the House, then it's easy to see how he would survive. Now, the question is, how does that reflect a tenable governing coalition and organizational coalition? Because if you think about what's broken down this Congress, the idea of a majority is just out the window. I mean, we've lost the ability to pass a rule, which was the fundamental building block for moving anything on the floor. We've the idea of passing a $1 trillion bill on suspension of the rules, a tax bill on suspension of the rules, the idea of needing to pass it on suspension of the rules is crazy and actually counterintuitive, because we all know, you know, at some level, like, the House is the majoritarian body. The majority does whatever it wants. The Senate's the one that has to act with, you know, a supermajority. Well, in this case, no. For anything to become law, for anything to go to Joe Biden's desk, it needs a supermajority. Now, that gets back to the tension I was talking about, which is that governing coalition, that governing majority. I think the governing majority presumably would protect a speaker that it thinks did the right thing. Does that enable that speaker to continue to be the leader of the party that nominally controls the chamber? That's the tricky part. That's what's the unanswerable question. You know, hopefully, if you're Mike Johnson, you can keep the Republican defectors down to one or two, and it's a moot point. But the minute that you have enough Republicans that want to force him into the arms of Democrats, that replays the mess that you saw in September, October, and at some level makes it an even more interesting existential question, which is, okay, at least with McCarthy, Democrats played the shirts and skins game and it just became, you know, a finger pointing game. What happens if Democrats actually step in and assist in some way, even in a passive way? That creates even more thorny political questions for Republicans. And my crystal ball is cloudy on that issue, but it's going to be interesting to watch.
Well, listen, it was really fascinating. The reading you were able to do, it sort of seems to me that there's basically a choice for Johnson between a governing majority, which involves a lot of Democrats, and leading the Republican majority, which doesn't seem to want to allow governing along those lines, or at least a very loud minority if the Republican caucus is out to prevent it. Liam Donovan, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Greg. Enjoyed it.
Folks, don't miss two articles up at TNR.com right now. Matt Ford on the Supreme Court's latest abortion case and James Robbins on Israel demolishing Gaza's cultural heritage. We'll see you all tomorrow. You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.